I'm joined today by Serap Kanai, whose work focuses on memory, gender, oral history, and African Cypriot heritage and trauma as primary research areas. She's also a freelance artist who uses installation art as a principal form of expression. And today we're here to talk about the Black African Cypriot experience in Cyprus. So Serap, thank you for accepting my invitation and welcome to the History of Cyprus podcast.
Hello, Andreas, and thank you for asking me to join you. And thanks for the introduction.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was very interesting to read those publications of yours because it's not often that we come across information on Black Cypriots. And in fact, in one of your papers, you used the phrase, the most visible, invisible group. And that struck me. So what is it that you meant to convey by that?
Yes, that is true. And it is something that I probably said for the first time in 2005, if not beforehand, but definitely it's in writing since 2005. Well, like you say, you don't come across too much writing about the Black experience in Cyprus, the Afro-Cypriot experience. Not only that you don't come across it in writing, but it doesn't really get acknowledged when we're living day to day either. So when I decided that I wanted to talk about this, that's the terminology I came up with, because we are here wandering around amongst the people of Cyprus, but not seen at all for who we are, that we might therefore have a different experience than the person next to you.
You mentioned that in 1999, you were at your uncle's funeral in London, I believe, and you said there was an overwhelming presence of Black Cypriots. What effect did that have on you back in 99?
It was overwhelming is the right word that you use, but it was also amazing and intriguing for me because not everybody were family, which is to that point, most people I knew were somehow related, you know, close or further related, but most people I knew were related. And because we were in a mosque that was mainly used by Bangladeshi community in London, I assumed that they were actually from the community there because, you know, it was the prayer time, whatever, and the funeral prayer. But then to realize that they came with us to the cemetery and everything and to find out that they were Cypriots, I was like, wow. And these are not family, and there are so many more Black Cypriots here, and I want to do some kind of work to kind of, as a homage to my uncle, who actually died like exactly 40 days after my granddad, who died in Cyprus. And then also, you know, to kind of say something about what I missed about not having these two men in my life who were like very important figures, especially my granddad, in my understanding of our Blackness, of our family.
So when did you first become aware of your Black identity or Black consciousness? Or is this something that you were always aware of as a child?
I think they let you know that you are different since you were like understanding anything. My very first memory is when I was about like four. When I was about 4 years old, I used to go to, well, we can call it kindergarten, which wasn't very far from where we lived, inside Old Town Famagusta. And there was a boy who used to also go to the same place, who used to wait for me in front of his doorway and hit me before I went. And then I used to go home crying, and then my mom used to come and bring me after that, and by this time he would have gone to school already himself. And then it took me a while to understand that this is why he was hitting me, because I was different, because I had, you know, like bonus hair, and somehow he didn't like me because of this. And the second time was a few years later when I did go to the first year of primary, because we had one school in Old Town Famagusta for many years that only first year primaries went there. And also I was standing aside, literally standing separated from the other kids during break times. And I think even the teacher kind of treated me differently in a couple of occasions. So I was aware from a very, very earlier on, basically. But to actually to say something about it or do something about it, it came later, probably when I went to London when I was 18.
So how would you characterize that experience growing up in an overwhelmingly Turkish Cypriot population? With those incidents notwithstanding, did you find it was a difficult experience or was it generally a positive experience with a few, you know, hiccups along the way?
Maybe something in between, but hard at times and okay at some other times. My kind of impression is that I had to work harder, which I think is a common experience about Black people all over the world when you're living in a predominantly white place, that, you know, to get, you have to kind of earn your place or gain a place within the society in order not to be so oppressed by everyone. So school was difficult in Paphos, which is where we moved after, you know, my first year in Famagusta. And there I was actually tormented by few boys in a constant sort of way. And I was called names, particularly about my hair. So it went like that. And they used to actually go to places that I used to go. Like I was learning English from a private teacher and she moved and they knew where she moved and they would go and wait for me before my class there and just to say things from to me, you know, about my appearance and about my hair. And they used to also do that at school. And one of the things I said, and I think is true before as well, there was a hierarchy of who can oppress who. You know, kids can be really cruel. This is true for everywhere. But it was like boys first, so they can oppress the girls, and then girls can oppress anyone that is different. And then they oppress disabled people. And then there was one boy who was disabled who everyone used to pick on before I arrived to Paphos because I wasn't from there. My dad was sent there. Well, we were actually exiled there anyway. And then he used to be able to pick on me because I was even under him, despite the fact that he was disabled, which was like seen as the lowest line because I was a girl and I was Black. So it was hard. And also people called names to my brothers. There is a general term that they use for Black people here is Arab, which is like the Arabic peoples, which are nation. But one of them is written with a B and the other one's written with a P. And that's one of the words that they use generally, but more so for the boys. And then they use another derogatory word for girls, which is halaik, which is I hate. And basically it's a slave woman because of the darker color. It's a darker color slave woman and who was used in the field as well as, you know, in concubate. You know, were used as a concubine or being raped or whatever. So it's not a nice word, but they use it still in Cyprus, despite the fact that I actually made quite a few complaints about it publicly. They use it for darker girls in the family, even if they don't have Black heritage. They think it's endearing. If you're slightly darker because of the sun or, you know, you're darker than everybody else in the family, they use it with a juk, which is something that we use for words to make them like sweeter. So instead of saying halaik, they say halai juk because she's little and it's meant to be sweet.
So, yeah, that's a common thread, I think, in a number of societies where there's this justification that the intent is positive, but without realizing the power of these words, which is it's definitely not unique to Cyprus. I can say that with certainty. Now, you in your research, did you find that the majority of Black Cypriots see themselves as Black? And I use the word Black with a capital B. Or is there a generational difference in identity? In other words, are Black Cypriots more aware of their Black identity today as opposed to, say, 50 years ago?
Yes and no. What I found when I talked to people, because I started talking to older people first when I started, you know, talking to other people back in 99 and then predominantly in Cyprus from 2000, people were aware their blackness, but what I've been discussing with a young man who kind of helped me these days is that there's a difference about people acknowledging that they have black or African heritage, as we call it these days, or that they identify as a black Cypriot. I myself identify as a black Cypriot, and so does some other people that I talk to, you know, formally and informally for my interviews. And some of them might be a bit younger, but for example, one of my very first interviews were in London with this woman who must be now in her 50s, and she identified as a black Cypriot herself even then, you know. But others acknowledge that they have African heritage, but they don't necessarily want to formally identify as a black Cypriot. They just call themselves Turkish Cypriot with African heritage, which is a sort of nuancing difference, but I understand it now and don't get upset, because I used to get upset about people not acknowledging it. And it's interesting that I actually found this, you know, I'm looking into finding some Greek speaking Afro Cypriots as well. And
right.
I managed to find two people. Actually, I found a bit more than two, but I managed to talk to two people who are brother and sister, and they were both sociologists, and they don't see themselves as black, but they talked to me about their grandfather, who they named as, you know, black African kind of thing. So, you know, in between reading between the lines, and then after you talked a while, then you see that they have suffered some things, although they might not look like me, definitely. But they kept on referring to their granddad as looking black, and not looking black themselves is like how they kind of differentiate about, do you own the heritage or do you own the identity?
Do you feel Turkish Cypriot as well?
The way I identify myself was Turkish speaking black Cypriot is what I identified myself as back in 1996. And now I identify myself as a Turkish speaking Afro Cypriot. So, I mean, I'm having to be a Turkish Cypriot when we have to talk about Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots. And then I'm saying a Turkish speaking Cypriot without saying the Afro bit in that section. But yeah, definitely, because, you know, I grew up in this culture and I have, you know, all the elements of the culture and the upbringing, and I live here now as well. So yeah, I mean, knowing, wantingly or not wantingly, you are kind of having to be in that position.
You mentioned that you didn't always, you weren't always in Cyprus. You moved to London when you were 18. I want to circle back to that, because I'm curious, what brought you there in the first place?
Couple of things. As I mentioned earlier, I was taking private lessons when I was like 9 in English. So I kind of, I had the second language, and then it came to schools anyway afterwards as well. We had it in the last year of primary. And then I went to a school where all the education was in English, which was the college to begin with, which was only in Nicosia at the time. And then at the time that I was to go to university, they had the troubles, you know, a lot of political troubles in Turkey, which was another place that people went. But the college I went actually educated us that we could go either to England or to the US. That's what the school was doing. And it was only in the last couple of years of the high school that we had to, you know, read lessons, study lessons that would enable us to go to Turkey as well, to universities in Turkey. But then Turkey was very troublesome, and my father wouldn't allow me to go to Turkey because he thought that I will be in trouble and probably get myself killed, which probably was what was gonna happen. And anyway, in 1980, there was the coup in Turkey. So the military took, you know, over, and a lot of young students were killed in sort of clashes between the right and left. So that was one of the reasons. And the second reason was that, you know, because I studied everything, that I was prepared to go to a university in England. One of my uncles then took me to England in order to be able to go to university there, which didn't happen the first time around. I actually came back after I went there at 18 and went back when I was 23. And that's when I stayed 17 years. And I actually went to university as a mature student when I was 31. So,
yeah, you mentioned that you were aware that you were different in an overwhelmingly white Turkish Cypriot community. Now, when you went to London, did you become even more acutely aware of your identity and differences? I mean, what impact did that have on you being a Turkish-speaking Black Cypriot in the UK?
It was fun. It was fun, you know, in a funny way or a strange way. It was interesting, very interesting, because the family I went to, like my uncle, and there was another uncle that I went to live with, we were all very visibly Black. Just being on the street, you met with loads of Black people, so you didn't seem in the minority anymore, although, of course, in London there were many white people, but, you know, there were more of us as well. And I could navigate, because after not talking at all in English, I started speaking. And I realized that to get away from the prejudice or to get away from a different kind of prejudice, or I faced a different kind of prejudice, but anyway, to get away from the prejudice of the Turkish-speaking community in London, I could just not speak Turkish. I could just speak English. So they couldn't see that I was Turkish Cypriot or Turkish at all in any way. So that was an interesting experience. And listening to people or on the bus or directly when you went to the shops and how they kind of reacted to you. Of course, then I became much more aware of the general racism towards Black people in London, also by minority ethnic communities as well as the white population. So that was kind of interesting. And that kind of went on like that I didn't speak to the Turkish shops, I didn't speak Turkish until I had my daughter and I decided that I wanted to speak Turkish then. And then people were kind of surprised that I was now all of a sudden speaking Turkish. In fact, it became really... Yeah. Funny as well that there was one Turkish shop and I was very friendly with a Black woman, like really, really close. And it came to the point that they complained about her not speaking to them in Turkish, that they thought she was a snob because they thought that she was my sister and that I was speaking Turkish when I went to the shop and my sister wasn't, because she was snobbish. In fact, she's not Turkish speaking at all and she's not my sister. So, yeah, I was kind of congratulated, you know, for considering myself part of the community and talking to people in Turkish and all that kind of thing, which was funny in a way that the situation became reversed, because in some shops they would speak next to me thinking that I don't understand and they will say bad things, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That was interesting to see it reversed in that way. The thing that happened, though, also in London, when also it relates to your earlier question about do I feel or identify as Turkish Cypriot, so it was okay to kind of count myself as part of the Black society in London. Most people would have thought that I was Afro-Caribbean. Basically, people didn't think I was African, but then they would think that I was. But then I was an activist in London, and then I had dealings within the Black community there. And then it was important for me to be Cypriot in that sense. And then it was important then to acknowledge my Turkish Cypriotness, because when you say Cypriot in London, and maybe less so now, but still it goes on, people assume that you speak Greek. They assume that you're Greek Cypriot automatically. So in that sense, you know, I had to say that I'm Cypriot, so then it could be understood that I might have a different experience to the other people from where I come from, at least. And also that it would be acknowledged that I am within this struggle as someone who comes from Cyprus, that I am a sort of Cypriot activist, if you like, who speaks Turkish. So that was kind of important. So I emphasized those bits of my identity within those circles. But then I might just stay sort of, you know, let people think whatever they did, they wanted to think otherwise in other circles or on the street or whatever.
Did you find while you were in London that when the Turkish Cypriot community would see that you were Turkish speaking, did you find that they responded to you in a more positive light? I mean, I just know that when we meet other Cypriots abroad, it's exciting because, yes, you know, Cyprus is such a small island. Did you find that that experience in London was a bit different than in Cyprus with the Turkish Cypriot community?
Yes, actually it was. And yes, once people, especially again, relating to me becoming a mother and my daughter going to school, people, and because of my English as well, quite a few of the Turkish Cypriot mothers and some of the Turkish mothers didn't speak English, and their children didn't speak English when they first started school as well. And I was kind of a little community leader, if you like, amongst those people. And I was a was liaison person with the school and the families like that. So they really appreciated me then. And they were very nice, you know, on the whole, they were actually very nice. And some of them I still see when I go to London now on the street or something, and they still acknowledge my presence or who I am. So, yes, it did change. Also that, you know, when events took place, then I went to those events. Then, you know, as I said, I emphasize my roots from here. Then it was different. Yes, it was.
Now, we're certainly going to come back to the Black Cypriot experience, which you've written quite a bit about. But I was hoping now that we could just kind of get a sense of the origins of the Black community. So I know Ronald Jennings wrote a little bit about that. But what do we know? What do we know historically? How?
Okay, and when one of the first things that we know is from Jennings specifically, but I mean, from what I found and from the things that I read, I mean, there are Blacks in Cyprus from Roman period. You know, they had slaves of all sorts, and they had people who they brought here under different kind of capacities. So we have evidence of that. We have evidence in pictures. We have some evidence of Black figures in pottery. So we have, you know, some evidence of influential Black people also, not just the slaves or workers, domestic workers. But the latest thing that has been taken, you know, systematically, that's been recorded, is what we have from Jennings, which goes back to 16th century. So it's 1590 to 1640 is what he wrote. There's one article, Free Blacks and Black Slaves, that Jennings wrote. And there he talks about how and why Blacks were brought here. So one of the reasons is that there used to be plantations, sugar plantations, and also cotton plantations in Cyprus. And people were brought to work at these plantations. And they were mainly brought via Limassol, which was a main port at the time. So that there was a concentration of Black people around Limassol, and specifically near Episcopi, Episcopum, which is where the sugarcane plantations were. The other place we know of where there was a small concentration is Hristofu or Christoforu, because there was a gold mine and people were sent there or punished, you know, if they didn't behave, in quotation marks, in the sugar plantations, they would be sent to Hristofu for harder work. So there was a smaller community there. Some villages around Episcopi, like Siligu, Evdim, all these villages have Black people coming, and especially Episcopu was predominantly Black people. And also, of course, there are streets, neighborhoods in Limassol, that were predominantly Black people, which was near the port. When I was growing up, everybody used to ask us if we came from Episcopi, because that's where they knew where the concentration of Black people were. But then no, we didn't come from there. And the second concentration is in Mesaria Plain, which is Mora and Sinde, which is like in the middle Mesaria. And we didn't come from there either. So
Do we have any idea, any clear idea about which African countries or regions Black Cypriots are descended from?
Yes, we do. And I got most of my information to begin with from people's memories. You mentioned I work on memory. So my main interest in this was to see what people's perception of themselves were and what stories they knew, and if there were any stories that they were handed down, you know, from their parents or grandparents. So most people said Sudan and Egypt. Some said Liberia, but mainly it was like the Sudanese area, the Muslim area of Sudanese people. But then people look different, you know, appearance-wise. Some of us look Muslim Sudanese, but some of us also look African Sudanese also. So, and Ethiopia was one of the places that was talked about. The old Habeshistan was one of the places that, and Eritrea were the places that were talked about. And since then, I have done DNA. Now DNA is fashionable, so I have also done my DNA, my dad's DNA, and also my mother's DNA, and we have Sudan. My dad has a very clear Sudan. My mom has clear Sudan. I have more than that. I actually have some Congo in my DNA, and you know, East Sub-Saharan and East Africa also. So. You know, the Sudanese that I kind of came up with seems to be, what's the right word here? Seems to be acknowledged or proved via the DNA as well. And quite a few other people also is doing their DNA and also coming up with Sudan. So those areas that I kind of found out in the beginning are actually the areas that most of the people were brought from. So people came because they were brought to work in places that I mentioned already. Later on, people came as free to work as healers. So they were like midwives that did much more than midwifery, like, you know, sorting out broken bones and sorting out some kind of small ailments. And also they were beauticians. They are today what we know as beautician and hairdresser and, you know, nail people, everything sort of put together. There used to be women that did this, that traveled across Cyprus to wherever there was weddings. They were called Gelinon Aracı, which were like the woman who prepares the bride. And they would travel to wherever the wedding would be and then get the bride, because, you know, in those days there were no makeup before you got married, and there was hardly any makeup anyway. But then, you know, any kind of makeup didn't happen until, you know, you become a bride. You weren't really, you know, because people used to get married younger anyway. So that was another thing. And also that they were musicians. So some people, men and women, came as musicians also, who used to play at the weddings, because again, in the olden days, men and women used to be separated when they were celebrating the weddings. So in the woman's celebration, only blind men and women musicians were present, because men celebrate now, separately.
That's fascinating. Did the bulk of African migrants assimilate to the Turkish Islamic culture? I know you said that in your recent work you're trying to identify Greek-speaking Black Cypriots, which has been a lot more difficult for you to kind of nail down. So was that just typical, given that it was the Ottoman administration that would have brought Afro-Cypriots to Cyprus?
It was actually both the Ottomans and the British, because then they were, you know, there's always been like division between people of Cyprus. So,
right.
so basically they kind of named us Muslims or Christians, and then it depended on where you were placed, basically. So there are actually, that I know of, I haven't talked to them maybe directly, but I know even more of them now. Even recently, I talked to some people like last week in Brussels that they have grandparents who are Christians, who they themselves are Muslims, you know, brought up. So one of their grandparents or great-grandparents are actually Greek-speaking Christians. So this is how it happened. So then in the Ottoman times, we were either Muslim or Christian, and it depends where you were sent then to school, and then they became kind of. And then when the British came, then, you know, just further the division, then they said Turkish and Greek. And then that's how the kind of separation happened. So you became Muslim mm-hmm. and Turkish, or Greek and Christian, on the other hand. And I know of one family that I interviewed, you know, the woman passed now, but she remembered very clearly that the people of her ancestors that came, there were four of them, and two of them were given to what you call it, Christian families, and two of them were given to Muslim families, and they used to meet, she said, but then they kind of lost touch afterwards. And also there was a research that one of the Greek journalists did after he came and listened to my talk at the University of Cyprus, that he did this article, and he actually found this family who were three, two brothers and a sister. One of them was Christian, Orthodox Christian, the other one was, the woman were Muslim, Mehrem, and the other one was taken in by a Catholic nun, so he was a Catholic priest. So, you know, all these things happened, depended on where you got placed. Yeah, it's very interesting, because this person was taken by the mother or by the father, and met the uncle and the aunt on the other side. So they all came from different places, because that's where they were given to, or they ended up at. So that's another kind of tragedy, I think.
Yeah, you mentioned that, for example, the three brothers, I believe they were the Mercan brothers.
Yeah, Mercan. Well, Mercan, the name, the word Mercan is like the color red, or the burgundy red. Also, Mercan is something that you find in the sea, you know, which is kind of pinkish red. Yeah, one of my first interviews said about that there were three brothers. This is her knowledge, that there were three brothers that were here, and they were sent, you know, Lefke area, which is where my dad comes from, around there, Flasu, you know, that area. And then the Angolem also. But then the other one was sent to Mesaria, which is other people come from. And then the other one was kind of, you know, in the middle. And this is where we all grow up from, and then people married themselves, each other, whatever. And the Mercan that I found is this this sash that the men who worked in houses in domestic service, that they weren't field workers, but they were house workers for rich people, wealthy people, that it was something that they had to wear. So they would wear a black trousers and a white shirt, but then they have this wide belt, a sash that was in this color, Mercan color. And they basically, I think, because when people were brought here, they didn't have the language necessarily, and their names were not acknowledged. And once they were, you know, given either a Christian identity or a Turkish Muslim identity, then this is the name that they were given to them. The same goes for the name Abdullah. It means Abdul Allah. It comes from there. It means the son of Allah. And now it became a name. So they didn't have a name for people. They just called them son of Allah, basically. And then it became a name, and some people now even use it as a surname. So when you hear Abdullah, you should look that either themselves directly are Afro-Cypriots or Afro-Heritage Cypriots, or they definitely have the heritage. No completely white person has this name, or the Mercan name. So these are the clues that we kind of find. And also the same in Greek, like we also have names like Kara here. So if somebody is called Kara or they have Kara something in their surname, then you know that they have some kind of African roots, the same as Mavro and Mavrodis in Greek. These have roots, if not.
That's very interesting.
Yes. So, and this has come true because, you know, I found people who are Mavrodis and they are black. So this is how you can kind of follow on that one. One of the other stories that this great aunt, this is the one that remembers about having two given to the Christians and two given to the Muslims, that said the great aunt, she used to speak a different language, but they didn't understand what she said. But there was one word that she always used when she was like angry or cross with the children. And also she used to make a special, she was one of the healers, and she used to make a special ointment that was good for all sorts of things that she also had a special name for, but they didn't know what this word meant. But she remembers that, you know, this woman used this word, and when she kind of cursed or, you know, just said something under her breath, this would be her language, whatever she remembered of it. And that they used to not wear shoes, she also said, when they met at the beach in Limassol, that they didn't wear shoes was one of the things. One of the other stories is about marriage and who do you mix with? Do you marry other black people or other people with African heritage, or do you marry white people? And there's like a definite kind of division about this. There are people who preferred to stay within the black community, and there are people who definitely wanted to get away from it. And they called it boyayı açmak. This is including my aunt, who's still alive, and who did that to her children. And she used to say it to us when we were little, and I thought she was joking. It's just basically lightening the color. Mm-hmm. And she said you should marry lighter people so the color gets lighter in the family. And she has three children, and they're all married, so whiter people than themselves. So she has, like, green-eyed grandchildren now. So this was something she said that we all thought that was a joke, but apparently she meant it. So this is not only true for my family, but other people also have this experience about lightening the color. So I think that kind of goes back to the prejudice that people must have experienced, or even racism that people must have experienced, that they wanted not have their children or grandchildren suffer the same thing. So they thought, because, you know, whiteness is always the currency.
Right. You know, you mentioned, and I want to just read a quote here from you. You write, when I talk about the experience of racism in Cyprus, I don't mean racism as it is understood and indeed experienced in many countries of Europe or the USA. How then would those experiences of Black Americans or Black Canadians differ from that of Black Cypriots?
That's what you just quoted. That's written in a paper that probably I wrote in late 90s. Since then, things have changed. And it's not completely true, that statement, anymore. So I must mention that firstly. But basically, what I meant at the time was that because of most of the people, you know, the invisibility that we talked about in the beginning. So the invisibility worked. I don't know if that's calling it a positive way is the right word, but it worked in a way that you were part of the society, if you like. And because you were part of the society, although you might have suffered prejudice, or you might, you know, as a child, you might have had a hard time because they called you names and everything. And yes, there were some unfairness in jobs, especially like in the police force for some people, not all of them, because, you know, we have at least two men and one woman, and maybe even a third man, who were like the highest ranking police officers, you know, in the force who became. But then there were others, like my father, who remained as a basic police officer also because of their views and because of, you know, the historical kind of genetic attributes of Black slavery and how they carried themselves. So, but on the whole, they might have been prejudiced and you might have been, you know, you might have not been acknowledged that you might have a different experience than other people and not acknowledged that you might have been called names. On the whole, there wasn't a systematic power, you know, used on you like they do in Africa, I mean, in the US or in Canada, that they say they set out rules and laws that, you know, wantingly, knowingly oppress Black people or keep them in a certain place. So we didn't have that here. That's what mm-hmm. I mean. That's what yeah. I remember. That wasn't my experience at the time anyway.
Well, no, but then there's colorist microaggression. Oh, I don't know if this is from the same
always. No, I mean, and I learn more about that now because maybe that I was experiencing and other people were experiencing. I mean, I'll just give you one example, something that happened to me in primary school. So we arrived to primary school in 1968 to Paphos. We were outsiders. We were a Black family. It looked like as if we were the only one, but we weren't. There were two other Black families already there, but they were from there. And that both of them had two daughters, I mean, girls, that were in my class. And their color was maybe even darker than mine, color-wise. But their hair was not kinky African hair. Their hair was in plaits, and it went down. My hair always went up, still does. You know, it wasn't. They didn't have Afro hair. So maybe because I was an outsider, but maybe because of my hair, you know, I received prejudice and name calling that they didn't. So these kind of things happen to a lot of people, I think, in other places, but, you know, coupled with, as I said, that maybe we were from outside Paphos to begin with. Although I think people in Paphos was generally very nice and really kind, and we have some, you know, links with them still today. But my experience at school was like this. And also one of these women, she became a woman, one of the girls, even like in recent years, when I started doing this work, actually I didn't see her for many years. And in 2005, when I did the first visible work, my visual work, she contacted me and she said that her husband had Black people in her family, in his family, and her husband was a Black person. And I thought she called me because she was from a Black family, because I knew that she was, and she has a sister that looks as Black as coal, basically. But she doesn't consider herself Black, which is interesting because she doesn't have Black hair. Neither does her sister. Her sister's Black as coal, but she has straight hair. So,
wow, so the impact of hair, and then this
hair is a big deal. Yes, yeah. Hair is a big deal, and I think the microaggressions play a big role to do with hair, lightness of your skin, and it kind of works within the family institution of family, because, you know, family is a small version of society, isn't it, institutional wise. So that's how things, the power dynamics work within that the lighter children in the family might be favored more in some families, and the darker children are not favored so much. I mean, I have one example from one of my interviews, if I may quote, that she said they had nicknames for each child. There was, I think there are six girls in that family, no boys. And she was called Midnight because she was the darkest one. One of them was Daybreak. She had blonde hair when she was little. The other one was like the middle of the day. Somebody was, you know, late afternoon. Somebody was early evening, depending on the sort of light of the day, yeah, basically. And she was called Midnight. And I was like really surprised and really shocked to hear this is how she grew up, you know. And she ties her hair, again, relating to hair. she still ties her hair. She's like, I don't know, 1954 born or 56 born, something like that. And she has headaches all the time because she doesn't let her hair, because she thinks it's going to bounce too much. So she forever, she's been tying her hair. And she has a very wide forehead because she keeps on pulling her hair back. And she thinks that looks also, you know, weird, because she called it an airplane field, in fact, herself. That her forehead is like an airplane field because of what she saw within the family, you know? Which
it's you know,
what's happening in the society.
Right. You know, hair being such a symbol of identity and expression and in some cases resistance, right? I mean, it's been brought to, I guess, public attention, the significance of hair in Black communities. And you actually mentioned it being a source of both pride and pain, you know, and that really comes through in some of these stories that you're sharing.
I mean, for me, it's like my mother was trying to, I'm using this word, which is something that is used in the article about the hair article that I co-wrote, is taming your hair, you know? So because of how the society is seen and how the society saw Afro hair, it needed to be tamed. It needed to be tamed in order to be presentable. It didn't look presentable to the society's eye. So the mothers were forced to make our hair presentable, which caused us a lot of pain. It says in the article that the common word that everyone, the first word that everyone expressed in that was that it was pain, you know, because we all suffered pain in order to get our hair presentable. But, you know, my mother used to get our hair cut every 2 weeks, like a boy's haircut. And that also caused another thing, because then the girls at the time were supposed to have, you know, beautiful hair that had all these bits and pieces in your hair. That's how you went, you know, with ribbons and stuff to school. And then me and my sister didn't have the hair. And then later on, my sister did, but I didn't, because her hair was actually curly coming down while mine was just going to the sides and going up. And then my mother got my hair straightened when I was 9 the first time. And this carried on and off until basically I went to England when I was 18. And then since then, I don't straighten my hair. And nowadays, you know, you mentioned as protest, I wear my hair as a statement or as a protest or both, you know, as something that I'm proud of. And this is how it is. And you just have to put up with it, basically.
Right. Definitely. You did talk a little bit about how there's these microaggressions and you know, there's microaggressions that you find in public, and then there's the microaggressions in the private sphere, typically in you know, amongst families. And you know, you mentioned that your aunt wanted to whiten the, you know,
lighten,
that's right. So these interracial marriages, were they, I mean, how common would you say they were? And when they did happen, how supportive or unsupportive generally were they?
Okay, so I think it's 50-50. And you know what I was saying about some people went to stay in the community and some people didn't, and some people just said there wasn't any kind of difference. They said you just married who you loved, and that's true for some people, but not always for everyone. So yeah, I would say 50-50 people did marry you know, outside the community as well. But there was also at one point that the Black people were not accepted, you know, boy or girl, that Black men wouldn't be given, as what we call it in Cyprus, you give your daughter or you give your son. So they weren't given their white daughters, or the other way around. So for example, there's one example that there's this police family who were respected because in one of the locations in Cyprus, who were like, had a lot of upper class people, descendants of Ottomans or something, you know, Ottoman families. And they lived in very big houses on mansions. And if you were a teacher and a policeman, you would be respected within the society and respected by them as well. And on one occasion, somebody wanted to marry, the son of one of these people wanted to marry a daughter of a black family. And that was definitely no-no. So that was, they were told the respect is up to a point, but not to give your, you know, our son to your daughter who's black and also a lower class as well. So there was also actually classism also played a role in this. In other places, yes, maybe there were love, but then most of the cases, I have at least two cases of mother-in-laws not wanting, well, actually more than two, mother-in-laws not wanting the daughter-in-law because they're black or they're darker than this. So, and one woman actually has it for her children. One woman had it for her mom and dad, like her mom and dad basically had to get away from her dad's family because the dad wanted the girl's hand and he was refused, and he went again and he was refused again. And at the end, they kind of, you know, had to severe contact with the woman's family and get away in order to get married. And later on, they were accepted. But, you know, it always stayed a bit strained, the relations between them, and they actually lived in a different place than where the parents were. And then in the other case, the man was blue-eyed and blonde and handsome counting, and the mother-in-law never liked the woman. And when she had children, the boy was darker, and the mother-in-law didn't really like the boy, like until he was like five, when the second child came and it was a fair daughter, and the woman liked the daughter. And when she was pointed out that the son also needs affection, the grandson also needs affection, she kind of said, oh, never mind, he's a boy anyway, so it doesn't matter that he's like that, you know, this kind of thing, and which upset the woman a lot. And in another case, there is two daughters, and the paternal grandmother doesn't like the darker color one because she never liked the daughter-in-law because she's darker. And this is also is the woman who hasn't shown her hair to her husband for like never, almost for 20 years marriage, you know, through 20 years marriage, that she never shown her true Afro hair. She always, you know, treated her hair, did something to her hair, and then she started wearing wigs. And it wasn't until the pandemic when she was like 70 that she decided, because you can't go out, or all her age group had their hair cut short because, you know, we couldn't contact people and all that business. And then she actually cut her hair short and let it be shown as the Afro it is. And she said there were also friends of hers that were like friends for 40 years that were seeing her natural hair for the first time. So it's a big deal. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so a lot of these stories, I mean, these are sort of your
these two are my latest interviews from 2021.
These yeah, and this is like your bread and butter, especially when considering that Black Cypriots are marginalized in historical sources. I mean, they're not really represented, and you know, you have to turn to the oral histories, which is something that's not explored enough. But I'm also curious, what are some of the challenges in gathering these oral histories? And
basically, yes, there isn't that much written, because I think the conflict, and as I said, you know, the two main communities being kept separated here, that's been like the, you know, master issue in Cyprus. So the Cypriot Cyprus issue has been like the thing in our lives, the bane of our lives, if you like. And there wasn't any space for any kind of other communities or other kind of differences. You know, we don't even talk enough about the Maronites or the Armenians or the Latins that were here. Some of them are still here. So within that, people had to fit into wherever they were. And I think it was safer, or it must have felt safer for some people, not to then dig about their, you know, differences, if you like. Or they just assume that it would be better not to talk about it, because if they talk about it, that they might get more hurt or something, or that their children might be more aware of it, but maybe they didn't understand that the children were suffering anyway. But I think my mom's case is like that. I mean, she grew up in a, my mom actually has Afro heritage on one side of her family from my grandmother. But my mom doesn't look black like me or my dad, and my mom doesn't have hair like us. And she grew up in a village where most people are related to each other anyway. So I have interviewed some other people who are like cousins of my grandmother, who said things that you can understand that there were some prejudice and there were some talk, at least, even if there wasn't anyone oppressing anybody else within the village. There were some things going on and that people were aware of some kind of racism and prejudice, I suppose. But I don't know. She didn't acknowledge that part of the that part of her life, I think. And when I started doing the work, which was the first time when she saw me doing it after my granddad, then my uncle died in 99, that's when she asked, why am I doing this and why am I digging into it? And we were Cypriots, and why was I looking and what was going to change just because I was looking at it? And, you know, what was the point? And she doesn't do that anymore. I must say, but she was very strong. She felt very strong about it at the time, and even for a few years, not just then. I mean, even when I came back here to carry on talking to people, you know, I moved here in 2000 back to Cyprus in order to kind of investigate and talk to older people. She was still not convinced that this was a good idea, that what I was doing. But now she acknowledges that this is what I'm doing, and, you know, I don't know. She wouldn't call herself an Afro-Cypriot, I don't think. But she's okay with me kind of doing, especially now that I'm more vocal and more people are wanting to know. There has been a shift in her outlook about the subject.
But her point of view is not unique, and that's in the sense that the idea of blackness is a bit of a taboo subject, even within mm-hmm. the Black Cypriot community, if definitely. I'm not mistaken.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, that's why I think it was very important when I did the first visual work in Cyprus in 2005 that, you know, I called it Bizler, which means us, but I deliberately left it Bizler in Turkish, and connections, which was like, you know, connections. So I had 240 photographs of, you know, mainly family from both sides, but also some other people as well, that were suspended from a ceiling of about 6 meters high that came down to about 2 meters high, that you walked amongst people. They were on press box, and then they used to move. And I had 15 interviews all mixed up together in sound, and it was like a full of black people that you came to see, or you just wandered around. So that was very effective, and that was the first time that we became visible. And that's when people said, "Hello, you know, we're also Black Cypriots. We also have some people in our family." And I think I did that because I wanted that invisibility and the visibility to come down and the visibility to come forward, you know? And I think that achieved that. I mean, including the person that I mentioned earlier who doesn't count herself as Black. She that's when she found me, and that's when she called me to say about, you know, having Black people in her husband's side. But a lot of other people like her, and people in the street, even like people at shopping, they would just come and say, "Hello, you know, we're from you as well. And we also have," and people send me photographs of their grandparents saying, "Can you locate my grandparents? And can you find out where we came from?" I still have that kind of thing happening now as well. So I think it was very important first step, if you like, in Cyprus when I came back. And since then, in fact, it was the first time that I met someone who said that he used to see black people in Limassol, and he thought first that they were foreigners, but then he listened to them and they were Greek Cypriots and they weren't actually foreigners. And where did all these people came from? So that's when I first learned that they were actually Greek speaking Cypriots of African heritage as well. So since then, I'm like looking for people to interview.
Yeah.
I think it's very important. It's not just, it's just that thing of being taboo that didn't allow people to acknowledge that bit of their heritage, I think, because it wasn't, maybe it was too painful, maybe because, I mean, one of my interviews said that maybe there were enough divisions within the Cypriot society that the minority of Black Cypriots, or the Black Cypriots were already a minority and Turkish Cypriots were a minority, so they didn't want to be yet another minority within a minority. Maybe that's why, because of the stupid conflict idea. So, you know, all these reasons, and my mom's generation, you know, she's almost 80, so those people probably, you know, hold on to Turkishness or Turkish Cypriotness more than any other kind of difference in their identity.
You know, there's evidence, obviously, that racialization is rooted in British colonial policies. Sure. Is there any evidence that Black consciousness, and again, when I say Black, I mean it with a capital B, mm-hmm. did that emerge in this period? Is that where we see the formation of that identity for the first time?
50s, I think, would be the first time, because again, one of my interviews informed me, and I did actually talk to this man who passed and now as well. He was in the police force, and he did ask Yor Gaggis, who was one of the interior ministers of the time, that he wrote a letter to him to say that the Black Cypriots should be allocated a separate village to live altogether. So I think the consciousness was there by some people back in the 50s. I don't know how much it carried on afterwards, but... Yeah. You know, until I started working and talking about it, I haven't really talked about, I mean, seen it as being a conscious movement. Although when I talked to people like back in 99 and 2000, one of the women that I talked to first said things that it looked like that it was acknowledged by her brothers who were also in the police force and seemed to have suffered prejudice, and they were aware that it happened because of their Blackness. So... Yes.
Have you had any interaction with the Black diaspora today? I'm talking about, you know, there's more now than ever before of Black students coming from a variety of different countries in Africa, studying in Cyprus. Mm-hmm. Have you had any interaction with them? And if you have, like, are they, I would imagine they're generally surprised to see that there is indeed a quote, you know, an indigenous Black community in Cyprus. How has that been?
Yes, I wanted to talk about this. When I said earlier that it's changed since the students came here and since the students become a crowd here, if you like. I mean, we have almost 100,000 students in the north of Cyprus in the universities now, and there are a majority of African students as well. So things have changed, and unfortunately there is racism in the north now, and I think there is systematic racism as well, because now we are on the side of the power. So there is like prejudice as well as racism against the students, especially Nigerian students, because of, you know, drug dealing and prostitution and all sorts of things. So, but then people don't understand who comes from where, so they're against all Black people, you know, they just label everybody the same. If there was like two Nigerians who were drug dealers, they think all Black students are drug dealers or dealing in prostitution and everything. So things have changed in that sense, and I'm sorry to say that. Yes, I have had dealings, because there was an organization, or there is still an organization called Voice, which is like the an organization that the foreign students in the universities here formed to help each other and, you know, to advocate on their behalf with the authorities. So I had dealings with them, and I knew the ex, he just left this year, the president, who was a president for a long time, someone from Cameroon. I actually met some students long time ago when they had fairs. They have like separate stalls, and you can go and meet them and talk to them. And when I say about what work I do, yes, they are generally surprised that there are Black Cypriots. It was really funny. Only like a couple of weeks ago, I was doing a tour And I went into the bathroom and there was this girl, and she was a black girl, and she said hello in Turkish. And then when I was coming, she said, "But how is it?" She said, "You are black, but you're Cypriot." And I said, "Yes, you know what, that we do exist." But there is an element of surprise there. I also, since you know my work has become sort of more known, I also had people contact me from the student community who does some things, you know, within the student community to talk to me. I talked to someone maybe 3 months ago. He requested a meeting that I talked to him, and he was trying to understand the dynamics of being a Afro-Cypriot and how come we don't do things differently, some things, and you know, we don't mix more. This was one of his questions: how come we don't mix more, and how come, you know, Cypriot girls on the whole, not that nobody does it, but or Cypriot woman doesn't go out with black men that are, you know, from Africa. These were some of his questions. Also, he was trying to understand. So, yes, it is kind of interesting how they see us. On the other hand, the Turkish Cypriots, now that there are more students and more African presence here, then they see us as one of them, and they get surprised that we are Turkish Cypriots also. So yeah, it works in that way too, that we get asked, "But where do you come from?" And like we're saying, we come from here, but they say, "But where?" We say, like, here, but then what, but where, you know? It's like this kind of questions. Or how come you're like this? How come you're like this? You know, is your dad from here? Is your mom from here? Whatever. I said, yes, we're here, like 7 generations. So yes, we are from here. But this is a question that I constantly get asked.
You mentioned that you're also an artist. I mean, and you actually hinted at some of the installation art that you've done. And this is one of the ways that you're engaging in a lot of, you know, in dialogue with a number of communities in Cyprus. Mm-hmm. Before we wrap this up, I really want to hear a little bit more about the art that you engage in and how this is a medium for you to explore Afro-Cyprianness. I mean, you mentioned the one where there was the images that were dangling from above. What is your intent with some of these installation pieces, and what are some of the events that you've hosted in the past?
Okay, so you mentioned already what the different things that I work as an artist. So, you know, like the trauma, the memory, the gender, and Afro-Cypriotness, all sort of wrapped up. You know, as a person, as an artist, as who I am, I'm interested in all of this, in all walks of my life. So my research is part of my art, and my art is part of my research. So the two of them go hand in hand. And the intent is, with all the work, is about recording the untold histories. So it's about the alternative history that existed alongside the official history, which is, you know, excludes a lot of people, a lot of communities, and a lot of people's experiences. I want to add this without it being submerged and getting lost within the official history. I want it to be alongside and to be known. And oral history is good, so you can get some information, but oral history, unless it's recorded, will disappear with me afterwards. So this is why I'm doing this talk with you as well. So then there's a recording here, and we'll have a record of it somewhere. And when I do the art and when I do the visual work, it's the same kind of thing. So I work on gender to show things that, as a Afro heritage Black Cypriot woman, what is my experience, and the other people who are similar to me, or other women, regardless of their Black or white identity, experience within the society here. So this is what I'm trying to show, and it's being taken under record is the main thing. So I'm an artist. I think you're an artist all the time. If you're an artist, this is what I believe. It's not that you become an artist later, is my philosophy about this, but let's say officially, since you are named an artist, is is like from the early 90s, end of, well, actually 1990 itself, was to be exact, is when I did anything to do with art and when something was had art in its title. So that's quite a while, yeah. Within that time, I'd taken part in the very first exhibition was in 1992 in Camden in London, where there were Cypriot artists from both communities. I did some paintings to music at the time. So that's what I was trying to kind of understand, what the music was doing and what you can do, express yourself. And then I started working, you know, on the Afro-Cypriot issue, actually 1996, but that wasn't so official. So from 99, so that was my first time that I exhibited something that talked about Black Cypriotness in Turkish society at the time. Turkish Cypriot society rather. And then I came here, and then I had the major exhibition that we talked about with the photographs in 2005, but I've been conducting interviews since 2000, 2002, 2005, 8, 11, 13, 220 to 21, even this year to 23. And I still do interviews with people. And I'm trying to, you know, wrap up the first book. I decided on 3 books for all my interviews, starting from the very early one until 1940, then 41 on to probably 70 or 80, and then 80 onwards with the younger people that I talked to more recently. I did some work on gender and people looking at nakedness and women and how disturbing this is. That was in 2020, my exhibition. And then what else? Oh, I took part in an exhibition in 2010 in Sweden. Again, there was Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots with the Swedish people, and I think maybe Norwegian also, artists in Sweden, where I actually put a lot of the heritage and the gender experience on a very, very large piece, a lot of text and a lot of photographs. And I work with photographs, and I also like to work with heritage. So I work with cloth because I come from a family of women who, my great grandmother used to be a weaver. My grandparents, also my aunts and my mum, were all dressmakers. So I have this heritage. I don't make anything dress-wise, but I always work with cloth also. So photographs, cloth, sound, text are the main mediums that I like to work with. And because of the pandemic, I did some abstract drawings, you know, a new language that I kind of developed, trying to express how I feel or what to understand what's going on since COVID, which is, you know, like really mind-boggling, I think, still in some cases. So yes, these are the kind of things I do. And recent times, I think it's partly because of the arrival of the students on this side and arrival of the immigrants in the South, or asylum seekers, because in the North, we don't have a thing about asylum seekers. We can't keep people here. We don't have a law about it, no legislation. So people are in transit. Even if they come here, we have to give them somewhere else, send them back somewhere, or send them to another country. So although some of the students are remaining here and work used as workforce, which is another upsetting thing, both in, you know, domestic services in hotels or gardeners or in construction and everything, it's more of a presence and more of a asylum seeking and wanting to stay in the South more so. So I think because of these, it became more interesting to notice what I'm doing, what I've been doing about Black Cypriots as well, and people liking to compare the two things and look for similarities, if there is one, and if they're going to kind of stay here and become Cypriots or whatever, have been some of the questions that's been addressed to me lately also. So we shall see what happens. But because of this, I'm doing more and more. Like, you're my second podcast. So I never done podcasts before in my life. So that's interesting. Yeah. I gave 2 presentations in the South you know, I've been written about in papers in the South. North is not so interested. There's one writer that writes about me, but she always waits for something new, something, you know, more new kind of thing. I don't know exactly what, but apart from her, nobody really writes and nobody's really showing proper interest because we have internal stupidity about politics here. So, but, you know, I've been invited to Köln twice, to the University of Köln, to give speeches about this. I talked in other countries, in England, you know, several times. So this has become my job now.
I got to say, this has been a fantastic conversation, Sarap. And keep up this work that you're doing. I mean, I think it's important work. I mean, you don't need me to say that. It is important work what you're doing, and it is fascinating work, and it's an important part of Cypriot history. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm really excited to find out, you know, the Greek angle of Black Greek speaking Cypriots. I'd love to learn more about that. And it's been fantastic to have you on. I just want to thank you. It was incredible.
Thank you very much. And thank you for helping to record it and, you know, taking it further. And I have found some Black Cypriots who will talk to me and who are willing to talk. It's just, you know, logistics about sorting out times. But since the last talk and the newspaper article, there are some more interests. So publicity definitely helps. So, you know, thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk. And yes, and I realized I've been doing the work forever, it feels like, but I realize more and more the importance of it because I can see, you know, how people look at it now in a different light than when I started doing it. So even if I don't get any kind of other support, people's beliefs and people's interest to take it further is a big, big deal for me. And one really positive thing is that young people get inspired and young people find angles that they can take their work further because of the work that I have been doing. So this is the biggest gift for me. And thanks.